Even people who never cracked a book from Laura Ingalls Wilder probably heard of the TV series from 3 decades ago, Little House on the Prairie. It still plays on TV around the world. The series on TV was based on the series of books Wilder wrote about her years growing up on the Great Plains as Laura Ingalls. The books are held near and dear by millions of people, and now we get to know the author better through a new collection called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. This is by no means the first book on Laura Ingalls Wilder handled by William Anderson, the editor. He's written a full biography of her along with a pair of other books and has written more than 24 works of history, biography, and travel in all. His work has also appeared in national magazines, and he's a frequent speaker across the country. William Anderson, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much. It's good to talk to you.
So what led to your own fascination with Laura Ingalls Wilder? She is fascinating to a lot of people, but what got you going?
I think that I was part of a vast group of American school children from the 30s, 40s, and 50s up until now that were indoctrinated in her books in elementary school. And when I was a third grader, I had no idea that a classroom in Oregon or New York State or Florida was going through the same rite of passage that we were. But our teacher took a book off her shelf one day and said, "I'm going to read you a book now that will tell you more about frontier life than our social studies book." And the title of that book was Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder. And we were used to having our teacher read to us before lunch, maybe after lunch. And I was not a particularly avid reader by third grade, but the exposure to all those wonderful books that our teacher selected, many of them Newbery winners, Caldecott Award winners, really got me interested in reading a lot more than I had been. And hearing Little House on the Prairie, which is a adventure story about a family against the elements, against the wilderness. It's the tale of the Ingalls family leaving their first home in the woods of Wisconsin, traveling by covered wagon to southeast Kansas, which was then Indian territory. Got all of my classmates fascinated in the subject we were studying, which was pioneers. And every day we look forward to the next chapter, to the next adventure of this family.
What would you say is the key to the appeal of the work of Laura Ingalls Wilder over all these years?
They're darn good storytelling. And that was a trait in the Ingalls family, because Laura Ingalls Wilder's father, Charles Ingalls, Pa Ingalls, was a wonderful storyteller. And he evidently passed that trait on to Laura herself, and then she in turn passed it on to her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a very celebrated and successful American author from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So these people just plain knew how to tell an engrossing tale.
Did you have the letters that are printed here available to you when you wrote your biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder?
I did, because it's interesting that someone is so well known for her life story, but her 9 Little House volumes conclude in the year 1889, when she was a young married woman on the prairie, struggling to homestead with her husband, Almanzo Wilder. And the big question that readers, children on up to adults, had, what happened next to these people? Where did they go? What did they do? What were their fates? Because we knew that these were true stories. They were about real people. They certainly weren't fictional characters. And we wondered, you know, what happened to them? So that was a question I had, along with gazillions of other people. And very interestingly enough, serendipitously, I started to inquire about those later years. I guess I had the early techniques of a researcher and a historian that I later became. So Laura did not write about her life from her 20s until her death in 1957 at the age of 90. So the letters that she left behind are the closest we have to hearing her words, her thoughts, her reactions to what happened to her as an adult. And when I wrote the biography, Laura Ingalls Wilder, A Biography for HarperCollins, I found myself relying on a lot of the letters for insights into her later life on Rocky Ridge Farm in Missouri and how she evolved as a writer and her dealings with family and friends and editors, and particularly her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who essentially collaborated with her mother in the creation of these classic American novels.
And was it Rose who kept the letters? Is that why so many of them survive?
They're simply all over the place. And Rose kept a certain collection of them, particularly in the late 30s when they were working on the books By the Shores of Silver Lake, On the Banks of Plum Creek, and The Long Winter. So fortunately, those letters were intact. The earlier books were written when Rose Wilder Lane was taking a respite from her very busy professional life and living with her folks on Rocky Ridge Farm in Mansfield, Missouri. So I'm sure that the discussions and the collaboration happened over the coffee cups or after dinner or on a visit, and they could do all this negotiating and discussing about the writing craft in person. Later on, Rose did purge some of the family papers. I don't think she was trying to cover anything up, but it was such a staggering amount of paper. I really think that earlier generations, and especially the Wilder family, they kept just about every scrap of paper they wrote anything on.
All right, we'll come back and talk more about the selected letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. We're talking to the editor, William Anderson, who's also written a full biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Back to talk more about the life of the creator of Little House on the Prairie on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the historian and biographer William Anderson, who had previously written a biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the writer of the Little House on the Prairie books. Now he's pulled together a bunch of her correspondence in a book called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. There's some great stuff in here. Well, join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have some particular memories of Laura Ingalls Wilder and her books. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking, William, about the fact that, sometimes people saved a lot of scraps of paper, but some of Laura Ingalls Wilder's correspondence did get thrown out, it sounds like.
It did. I outlined that in the introduction of the books because there are gaps. The first section of the book, and I divided it up into five eras of her life, when she was a young wife, young mother, farm woman, we don't have too much extant of those years. And the book has a rather slow beginning because of that fact. So I always say to people, stick with the book a while and it will get a lot more engrossing. And there was a fire in the Wilder home. Laura and Almanzo Wilder were farming on the prairie near Desmet, South Dakota, and their first little house burned down, so that would have erased what she might have had of her childhood or early married life. And then I think before she became very well-known and famous, it may have been less important for her to hold on to every letter that she received or be conscious to keep copies of those that she wrote. But her letters are truly scattered all over the world. I used some letters that she sent to Japan because she had a huge following, almost an idolatry, in post-World War II Japan. So I included some of those. I included letters to her friends, to her family, to her husband, Almanzo, because she made several road trips. And Almanzo was a fine farmer and simply did not want to leave Rocky Ridge Farm. But he was willing for her to go off on sightseeing trips, and she religiously wrote to him almost every day and was homesick. So we've got that collection, which shows the wonderful companionship between this couple.
Manly and Bess, they went by. I get how we got Manly from Almanzo, but how do we get Bess from Laura?
Almanzo had an older sister, also with the name Laura. And when they were courting, we call it dating now, they were talking about their names. And Almanzo said, well, what's your middle name? And she said, Elizabeth. And he suggested that he call her Bess or Bessie, because there was already a Wilder family member with the name Laura. And in the community, when she was a young wife and mother, she was known as Bessie Wilder. And sometimes even the old newspapers in the hometown would call her Mrs. Bessie Wilder. And her daughter, Rose, always referred to her as Mama Bess. So that's how that nickname evolved.
So there are some. You mentioned the fact that she wrote to the Manly just about every day, and mentioned being homesick. But it's something that little asides are just great. Like, don't ever tell Rose I said this. But you really get a glimpse into her. But one of the things that really jumps out is the clarity of the writing, which I suspect is her strength in the books as well. Is that she gets right to the point. There's not a lot of stuff. I mean, she describes things well, and she's very direct and to the point.
I agree, and I really believe that her forte was writing very spot-on description. She could make we third graders in my elementary classroom see how a log cabin was constructed. We could see how the well was dug. We could see Pa help rounding up cattle, plowing up the prairie, etc. And her early letters reveal that very, very well-defined skill. She actually made two long trips on her own. And the first was in 1915, and at that time, Laura and Manly's daughter, Rose, by that time Rose Wilder Lane, was a star journalist for the San Francisco Bulletin. In 1915, 101 years ago, was the San Francisco World's Fair. And Laura made that trip by railroad to visit her daughter, see the World's Fair, hopefully to write about the World's Fair for publication, because she was just beginning as a journalist. And she also had a strong desire to learn from Rose as much as she could about the writing profession. And on that trip, she wrote to Almanzo very frequently, and her descriptions of wading in the Pacific Ocean, touring Northern California, going to the splendors of the World's Fair are really, really wonderful writing. And then 10 years later, she and Rose and a friend made a car trip all the way from Mansfield, Missouri, once again to San Francisco. And that is rollickingly good fun to read about some of the roads they traveled on.
She couldn't wait to get out of
Colorado.
Kansas. Yeah.
They were like dirt trails. And right, you know, you look down and there was no end to down. And she confided in Almanzo that on one of those hairpin turns, she said, I had to pinch myself so I didn't scream. And she was very good about describing natural settings, and very tender with her husband. I remember one of the letters, she reminds him where his warm underthings were in the closet in case he needed them, and take good care of the pets and so on. So this shows the wonderful compatibility of that couple.
I noticed that you can find your underthings in the sock drawer.
Exactly.
That description from across the country. While she's busy dipping her feet in the Pacific for the first time, her description of that is really wonderful, too.
Yes, and I have to admit, this is not the first collection of her letters. In the 70s, Roger McBride, who was the literary heir to this family, discovered all of the letters that Laura wrote to Almanzo, bundled up, strings tied around them, and they were such a good collection of life in 1915 that he published the book West from Home about that journey to San Francisco and Laura's experiences at the World's Fair. So that was the first of the letter collections, and I included some of those excerpts in the current new book simply because I wanted to show readers that there was a definite evolution and an early capability of her solid writing back to 1915, and it didn't just all start in 1932 when she wrote her first children's book.
But in fact, I mean, there's a bit of a mismatch in some cases with what was said publicly and what's indicated here. It sounds like Rose certainly was the successful writer first. Did she deny at some points that she had given her mother a lot of help?
She definitely did. In that era, writing children's books was quite far down the totem pole for writers. Nobody particularly wanted to be a children's writer. And now we have literary superstars in the children's book field, and there's nothing demeaning about that. But at the time that Laura first published, Rose was at the height of her career, writing best-selling books, writing magazine serials, which was tantamount at that time to, say, writing a mini-series for television. It was huge. And Rose did not want her career to be a crossover that she was fooling around with children's books. So they kept their careers very separate, and Rose adamantly denied to friends that inquired and editors that she had anything to do with these books. She said at one point, "My mother can stand on her own two feet." So there was sort of a gentle cover-up, but for so many years, people were just so in love with the Little House books, they never thought about how perhaps they'd been crafted. It didn't matter.
All right. Our guest is William Anderson, a historian and biographer. He has brought out a new book about Laura Ingalls Wilder, the creator of the Little House on the Prairie book and the other eight in that series. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the selected letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder and her life in general. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. John in Ashland writes, "What does your guest think of the recent book, Pioneer Girl, the annotated autobiography by Laura Ingalls Wilder and Pamela Smith Hill?"
Pioneer Girl was truly groundbreaking. I have known about that autobiography for 35 or so years because Roger McBride placed all of the Wilder papers, both generations, Laura and Rose, some of Almanzo's, at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch, Iowa, in the very early 1980s. And among the papers were drafts and a typescript of Pioneer Girl. I had always known that it existed, but when I first studied those papers, I read Pioneer Girl, and as many scholars have done in the ensuing years, we've used that as a reference in writing scholarly articles, biographies, and other assessments of the Wilder literature. So it wasn't a surprise to me about its content or that it had existed. But the general public, who always seems to crave a new fix with another Wilder book, they didn't know it nor have access to it. And I know that at one point at the Hoover Presidential Library, which is part of the National Archives, they had quite a business of photocopying this whole manuscript for people that were willing to spend $80 or $90 on a full photocopied set. So finally, when Pamela got the idea to edit and annotate Pioneer Girl, I thought, at last, it's going to be out there for the public to read and access in an easy manner. And it was simply a runaway bestseller. It was published by South Dakota State Historical Society. The editor of the project is a longtime friend of mine, so I was privy to all the difficulties in keeping up with the demand. Nancy Copel, who edited it and launched the project, thought maybe they'd sell 7,000-8,000 copies. Those went out immediately, and then it was just a race with the printer to keep up with the demand. And finally, Pioneer Girl ended up on the New York Times bestseller list last summer. And I thought, Wilder really has staying power. She hadn't been writing for 70 years. She's been gone for 60 years. And here she ends up on the New York Times bestseller list, and kind of reminded me of the furor and the excitement about Harper Lee's book when it came out this summer, also with HarperCollins.
Oh, true. Go Set a Watchman. Right, right,
yes.
Right. So let's go back in time a bit, though. Guys, for the people who don't know the story, I mean, Laura, from the time she was 2 until she was 12 years old, her family moved around. It was Kansas, Missouri, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, back to Minnesota, and then into Dakota Territory. What were they seeking?
Well, Pa Ingalls was simply seeking a productive homestead. And he always seemed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was an ambitious man. He was amazingly skilled and hard worker. And when he would get to Minnesota, for instance, he would establish a new homestead, a new home for the family. And the grasshopper plague of the 1870s, which was notoriously hard on that part of the world, would wipe out the wheat crops. And wheat was king for farmers. Those early homesteaders did not diversify. They put all their hopes on the wheat crop because it was so lucrative. They were close to a railroad in Walnut Grove. Ideally, the wheat crop would be shipped up to Minneapolis or St. Paul, where there were mills, and they would have made it rich. But that wasn't in the cards. So Pa Ingalls was defeated on that, and at one point he had to walk back to eastern Minnesota to work as a harvester just to raise some money. Finally, the family gave up their farm along Plum Creek near Walnut Grove, Minnesota, and moved to Iowa for a brief while, and Pa helped to manage a hotel there. Well, he wanted to continue going west. They returned, as you said, to Walnut Grove, and then made one final thrust west to Dakota Territory, finally settled down in Desmet, South Dakota. But he even got the itchy foot there. He wanted to go to Oregon. He wanted to end up in Oregon. And finally, Caroline Ingalls, Ma Ingalls, just put her foot down, and she said, no farther. So they ended up in Desmet, South Dakota.
The letters in the book begin with what change of life for the Wilders? It was you pretty much start at where they're married?
The book starts in the year 1894, and that was the very first existing letter that I could find. And it's a good place for the book to start because that is the end of Laura and Almanzo Wilder's westward home-seeking life. They had been defeated on the prairie, just like Pa Ingalls had been. Soon after their marriage, they had a series of hardships. Their crops were ruined, and a drought set in. And they finally decided to give up this dream of a western homestead. And they'd heard about the Ozarks of Missouri. And a combination of the railroad companies and the real estate companies were trying to sell small plots of land in the Ozarks, and they gave out great promotional pieces saying that you could live on a comparatively small plot of land and live like a king. You could have an orchard, dairy, poultry, and so on. And the Wilders picked up on that idea. So in 1894, with their little 7-year-old daughter, Rose, they started on their last covered wagon journey. And there are two letters at the opening of the book, one of which Laura talks about leaving South Dakota, and the second was a travel letter that she wrote back to the old home newspaper. And it's interesting, that letter was published in the newspaper, and on the clipping, she had penciled, "My first published writing."
Huh. In the newspaper back in DeSmet?
It was, yes.
All right. William Anderson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, historian and biographer and collector of the selected letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder, his new book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange with William Anderson and the subject of Laura Ingalls Wilder and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. In third grade, today's guest got hooked on The Little House on the Prairie and the 8 other books by Laura Ingalls Wilder about growing up on the Great Plains in the late 19th century. William Anderson went on to become a historian and a biographer of Laura Ingalls Wilder and has brought a lot of her correspondence together in a new book called The Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Maybe you have some memories you'd like to share with us about your own reading of The Little House on the Prairie and its companion books and the works of Laura Ingalls Wilder. 800-838-3760, our phone number, email address jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about the first publication of a letter from for Laura Ingalls Wilder, which is a letter back to DeSmet, South Dakota, about her her formative years there. I want to talk about Rose briefly, though, her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane. How unusual was her career drive for its time, William?
Rose was part of that early thrust of the 20th century of the bachelor girl. And Rose was not acclimated to the country and agrarian life that her parents loved so much. So she learned telegraphy in the train station of the little community where they lived, Mansfield, and went on to Kansas City and other metropolises and worked as a telegraph operator. She was 17 when she started working. And that was unusual, somewhat shocking to old school people. But the Wilders let her go. That indicates to me they were understanding, and Laura particularly was quite liberal in understanding that Rose wanted a career. And then she drifted into newspaper work and was a Cracker Jack reporter and feature writer for the San Francisco Bulletin, wrote biographies of Jack London, Charlie Chaplin, Henry Ford, Herbert Hoover. After World War I, she was a traveling correspondent through Europe and the Mideast. She was a publicist for the American Red Cross, traveled to Albania, lived there for a while, wrote a book about that experience. And her real forte was as a short story writer. And she became very, very popular with the American media. Rose Wilder Lane's short fiction was published by all the major magazines, particularly the Saturday Evening Post. And she did serials for those magazines where the people would wait with bated breath till the next issue came to find out what happened next. Several of her books were on the bestseller list. She was a very prolific writer and also a ghostwriter for other authors. Let me see. I've lost it. But,
all right, but she was...
Lowell Thomas.
Oh, really?
Wrote lots of books for Lowell Thomas. But that was kept very, very quiet because, once again, she didn't want to be known as a ghostwriter. And she didn't want to be known as having any part of her mother's books. She wanted her mother to have the full credit because that somehow diminished her power in the literary world.
So Laura Ingalls Wilder herself, though, I mean, she had skills aplenty, obviously, from living on the prairie and living in farm life, had to know a lot of different things. But tell us about her loan work. This is a really interesting detail of what she ended up doing in Missouri.
Well, I mentioned that Rose was an early working woman, and Laura did the very same thing. Rocky Ridge Farm was a very pleasant place to live. It's beautiful. Visitors still go there. But it was tough farming that rocky, thin soil. So at all times, one, two, or three members of the family were doing outside work to contributing to keeping the farm going. And Laura took a job with the Federal Loan Bank as a secretary treasurer for these federal loans, low-cost loans to farmers. She had a little office, and she was a promoter of the Mansfield Farm Loan Association. Did that for a dozen years. Concurrently, she started a career as a country journalist and wrote about life on her farm, how to raise poultry. She interviewed other farmers, other farm families. She did feature stories. And that was for a publication called The Missouri Ruralist. Not to be taken lightly, because The Missouri Ruralist had a circulation of around 80,000 readers, and it was part of a chain, a syndicate for many states that had these weekly country journals. So she was very, very skilled at a variety of writing styles and assignments during her years on the Missouri Ruralist, and she was with them for about 12 years as well.
There's a great whiff that goes before this time, back to her years growing up on the prairie, and a letter back to De Smet on the 50th anniversary of the town's founding. Tell us about that.
The Ingalls family were the first permanent residents of De Smet. That would have been 1879 to 1880. Pa Ingalls had gotten a job working for the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. He was a bookkeeper, timekeeper, ran the company store. So that got them from Walnut Grove, Minnesota to South Dakota, and finally got Pa a good-paying job to give them a grub stake to start farming again. And they were very well-known in De Smet, well thought of, active in the founding of the church and the founding of the town and so on. And 50 years after, the town did a huge celebration, 1930, and Aubrey Sherwood was the editor of the De Smet News. Many of his letters back and forth to Laura Ingalls Wilder are in the book. He wanted her to write down memories of the very beginnings of De Smet. Each one of the Ingalls sisters contributed. So Laura, before she even started writing her books, was reminiscing about her childhood and growing up in the prairie.
And but when she did actually, she returned to De Smet at some point. She and Manley went back there. What did they think of what the town looked like 50 years beyond its founding?
Interesting. They thought it was a large community. I don't think the population was more than 1,000, but when she talked about how modern it was and how spread out it was, it made me think of it must have been a simple frontier village when they were there. And De Smet's population, I think, is about 1,300 now, maxed out around there. And they enjoyed being back in De Smet. But they always said they felt rather disillusioned because everywhere they looked, things were different, and no longer were the people that they were looking for still around. And they went back three times in the 1930s.
I love your detail about Laura and her sister Carrie going to Mount Rushmore. What did they find there at the time they visited?
Well, after those trips to Desmet, the Wilders then would drive out to the Black Hills, as people still do, because Desmet has a huge tourist trade with Wilder. And they're either coming or going to the Black Hills. And at the first visit, 1931, George Washington was on Mount Rushmore. So, of course, they went up there to inspect the progress. And every time the Wilders went back, there was an extra presidential head on the mountainside. And they really enjoyed that reunion with Laura's sisters. She hadn't seen them in some 30 years. And just simply being tourists, they had reached a point in their life where the farm was in the past, and Laura was making a pretty good income from her books so they could have a spiffy new car and go on a vacation.
The car got a name, too, I noticed.
One of the cars was called Isabel, and it was a blue Buick. That's the one that they used to drive to California. And later they drove Chryslers. I don't believe they named the Chryslers, but it was a progression. You always named the family horses. I guess their first car got bestowed with a name as well.
Mm-hmm. A lot of charming stuff in here, which you'd expect from the author of Little House on the Prairie. One of the things that is probably the most endearing is the exchanges of mail with people who wrote to her, school classes. You mentioned the people in Japan. So did Laura pretty much write back to everybody who wrote to her in admiration?
She told her editor at Harper and Brothers, Ursula Nordstrom, a very famous editor, "I cannot bear to disappoint a child." And she'd go down to the mailbox, which was the largest regulation mailbox the post office would allow, because her mail load was tremendous. She would get maybe 50 letters a day. On one of her birthdays, she got 1,000 greetings. And she would take all that mail back up to the farmhouse, sort it, and answer it individually. Now, when the classrooms would write collectively, she'd get 30 letters in a big brown envelope, she would write them a group letter and answer the individual questions. But she was very diligent about answering all that correspondence, and some of the parents or librarians or school kids would write her back, and she'd have an ongoing pen pal relationship with them. And I was thinking recently, after Almanzo died in 1949, she was, of course, very lonely. And what a nice thing. Every morning she'd have this huge supply of mail to be interested in and enjoy, and then writing those letters gave her something to do.
So given all the letters that she would have written, it sounds like there is potentially a very large trove of undiscovered letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder out there somewhere.
Absolutely, and I did, in the past week, three bookstore speaking and signing appearances for this book, and at two of them, kids from the 50s brought their letter in to show. And they're just plain all over. Some of the recipients of those letters are passing on, and their children are finding them. Oftentimes that has been a prized possession in the family, and they're donating them to the Wilder Museums or sharing them. And I put in a sampling of her responses back to the children in this book, because she not only saved all their letters, thousands of them, which are a good read, but the people that received them were so proud of them that they have saved them over the years. Really, there could be a multi-volume set of the children's letters and her responses, but I just put in the ones that I felt were the most representative.
What in this collection that you provided in the new book, the Selected Letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder, were the most surprising to you, as much as you had known about Laura Ingalls Wilder already?
I think that my feeling when I finally put all of this together under one cover was that she was the same person that people have loved from her books. She was one and the same. She certainly took her fame in a very humble manner. She was genuine. She was generous. She was somewhat dignified at times. She was a good representative of the best of the pioneer generation.
Laura was just past her 90th birthday when she died. How much did we know about her final years, which would have been, I guess, another 8 years after Almanzo died?
Well, as I mentioned, she was very lonely for him,
mm-hmm.
but she had a steady stream of her fans would stop to see her on their vacation.
Huh.
She would allow them to come in the house, and I always say Laura was the first tour guide of her home because they were very proud of that house they built. It's such a unique architecture. And, of course, thousands of visitors go there today on tours. I'm on the board there, and we opened March 1st. But this year, it was an especially exciting opening because we also opened the door for our brand-new visitor center and museum, which will be dedicated in April. But Laura would show people through the house. She was a charming hostess to them, even though they were total strangers. And as I said, the table or her desk was always piled high with letters that she had to answer.
Is there still a representative pile on the desk just to make it look like she might still be there?
You bet. We've got samples of the letters on the desk and on the dining room table where she sorted them.
You know, it's funny because I was first aware of Little House on the Prairie through the TV show when I was going to the University of Missouri, not realizing that she had lived so many years a couple of hours away in southwestern Missouri.
Right, and also Rose Wilder Lane lived in Columbia for about a year because she was doing research on a book and she used the University of Missouri archives.
I noticed that. Yeah, you mentioned her staying at the Tiger Hotel, which is that tall building in downtown Columbia you just can't miss. So some fun memories for just about everybody who picks up the selected letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder. William Anderson, the biographer of Laura Ingalls Wilder, put the collection together and joined us today in the exchange. William, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
All right, take care.